Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey.
Everyone's talking about red light therapy beds, and for good reason. There's a company called ARRC LED that's building an entirely new class of LED devices. ARRC LED beds integrate proprietary scanning technology and frequency protocols to shape the delivery of six different wavelengths in dose-optimized photobiomodulation. Yes, that's a lot of words. What it is, though, is that photobiomodulation improves the underlying energetics of the cells in your body. And those changes can benefit nearly every tissue and organ and system in your body. You change your cells and you change your life. For more information, visit ARRCLED.com. Hey there, ice bath lovers. Do you want to take your cold exposure game up a notch with some contrast therapy? Well, you should, because cold plunges and contrast therapy can lower stress, up your immunity, and even help you sleep better. It works better than just cold therapy alone. Well, now you can do that with the new Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tubs by Master Spas. Whether you want to relax in a hot soak or get energized with a cold plunge, the Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tub has you covered. You can easily hop out of the hot water, get in the cold water, and go back and forth. When you do that, you get better results in less time, and that's what biohacking is all about. Go to chiligoattubs.com, use promo code DAVE500, and you can save $500 on any Chili Goat cold tub. I have one in my backyard. That's chiligoattubs.com, promo code DAVE500.
Today's cool fact of the day is that mental cues can alter your physiology. A guy, a psychologist named Robert Ader from the University of Rochester School of Medicine. This is a famous guy who coined the term psychoneuroimmunology, which was very groundbreaking. He and his colleague, Nicholas Cohen, did these experiments in the 1970s. They trained lab rats to associate a stimuli with an event, like Pavlov trained dogs to drool when they heard a bell. But what these guys did is they gave rats an immune-suppressing drug that had sweet-tasting saccharin in it. And eventually, the rats got so conditioned to the effects of the drug that if they ate just saccharin without the drug, their immune system would also be suppressed. And years later, this was repeated in college students, believe it or not, and the same effect is true in humans, which means you can have a, quote, placebo effect at the cellular level, even though the college students did not know that they were given an immune suppression drug at all. They just knew, drink this weird tasting smoothie and come back and do it again in a month. Pretty remarkable effects. There's stuff going on in our bodies we don't know about. And speaking of things that we don't know are going on in our bodies, today is going to be a fantastic discussion with one of the guys pioneering Alzheimer's disease and neurodegenerative diseases in our brains. And you're going to learn a lot, even if you don't have Alzheimer's, you don't know anyone with Alzheimer's, you have a great chance of getting Alzheimer's disease, way more than you think, assuming that you don't get hit by a car when you're young. And it's entirely, maybe entirely is going a little too far. It is exceptionally preventable if you understand the things that we're going to share with you today. So this is how to take care of your brain for your entire life and some stuff that no one knew about Alzheimer's. Today's guest is Dr. Dale Bredesen. He's an internationally recognized expert in how Alzheimer's disease happens. And the Bredesen Laboratory studies the basic mechanisms behind neurodegeneration. Even if you're 20, you've already started a little bit of neurodegeneration. It's called aging. And the deal is you could go down a very bad path or dark path, or you could just have normal aging or maybe even not have much aging at all. And the things that you'll learn in this podcast today are awesome. And Dale's work, or Dr. Bredesen, has led to the publication of 220 research papers. And he just wrote an entire book called The End of Alzheimer's that frankly blew my mind. So Dr. Bredesen, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Dave. Great to be here.
We recorded our show on the deck of Dr. David Perlmutter's boat recently with Dr. Jeff Bland. And David Perlmutter and Jeff Bland have been guests on the show. So this was sort of the superheroes of anti-aging and brain science all on one boat. And then my memory card failed, so I'm recording another interview with you, which gives me a chance to pick your brain even more, and this is the one we're going to be publishing. So thanks for the extra time.
Yeah, thank you, Dave.
Tell me about Alzheimer's. What is it that you've figured out that wasn't in the conversation about Alzheimer's 10 years ago?
Yeah, there are several pieces to this. One of the major ones is that people have tried to study this by looking at very tiny data sets. So obviously you have a tremendous computer background. So, you know, if you went to an engineer and said, here's an incredibly complex organism. I've got 3.3 billion base pairs as the simplest part of, you've got, you know, tens of thousands of proteins with all sorts of modifications. Now something is going awry and I want to figure out how to fix it, but I'm only going to give you serum sodium, serum potassium, and a couple of other inputs. The engineer would laugh at you. This is much too big of a problem. But this is exactly what happens.
You're talking about looking at smoke to figure out what words were written on the page that was burned to make the smoke, basically.
Exactly.
Okay.
So we are getting much, much too small data sets when we look at people who have cognitive decline. And by the way, this relates, as you alluded to earlier, to normal cognition. So a lot of people, in fact, could do better with their cognition by following these same sorts of approaches. So what we did was to look at the fundamental nature of the neurodegenerative process and ask what is actually driving the biochemistry that leads to Alzheimer's disease. People right now come into the doctor and they say, I'm having trouble with my memory, I'm having trouble with planning, what have you. The doctor says, oh yeah, that's Alzheimer's disease. And we're not going to look at what caused it because we're going to tell you we don't know what caused it. This is like taking your car in and the mechanic says, oh, Dave, this is car not working syndrome. We know all about it. It happens in older cars. And you say, well, aren't you going to evaluate some of the basics? And the guy says, no, because those tests aren't reimbursed. That is how bad things are today. So when you look at larger data sets, and we currently look at 150 different variables in humans, which is a tiny number, actually, but it's far more than what others are looking at. What we found then in 30 years of research is that there are subtypes of Alzheimer's disease. So you can see, you know, type 1, 2, 3, et cetera. And also that this is a disease that is actually a protective response of your brain to different insults. So that you, if you look at what's actually causing the problem, then you can address that. And then we've had unprecedented improvements in people. We published the first paper back in 2014, another one in 2016. And we've got over 2,000 people on the protocol now and unprecedented improvements in people's cognition with documented Alzheimer's or pre-Alzheimer's, MCI, which is mild cognitive impairment, or SCI, which is subjective cognitive impairment. So if you actually look at what's causing the problem, you can get much better results.
Do you see people in their 20s with SCI, subjective cognitive impairment, or is this something that happens after 50?
Very interesting you should say that, because people definitely will get to an Alzheimer's diagnosis, which is typically about 20 years after you start the underlying pathophysiological process. And we certainly see it in people, a diagnosis of Alzheimer's, in their late 40s. So for those people, yes, it probably did start in their 20s. We also have had people begin to complain about what ultimately ends up as Alzheimer's, even in their late 20s. But as you know, in general, people start noticing the symptoms in their 40s and 50s. So that we have people, and it's often around menopause or andropause that people will begin to notice changes. So yes, it can be in your 20s. We recommend that everybody who is 45 or over get a, quote, cognoscopy. Just as you get a colonoscopy when you're 50, you should get a cognoscopy when you're 45. And you may consider pushing that back to late 30s because you want to know where you stand and you want to know what is the biochemistry? What is your status? What is your risk? Just as you would want to know your cholesterol, your LDL particle number, things like that for your heart, you also want to know where you stand with a set of biochemical, genetic, and cognitive parameters, which are relatively easy to test.
So what is in a cognoscopy? What are those parameters?
So if you go back to what's actually driving the decline, It is related to anything that produces inflammation. So chronic inflammation, whether it's from Borrelia, whether it's from HSV, whether it's from P. gingivalis or other organisms, or it's from leaky gut or a poor diet, on and on. These things, anything that produces inflammation. So we want to look at your, we want to know, Dave, your HSCRP. You probably know your HSCRP. As you know, it should be less than 1.0.
That's C-reactive or high-sensitivity C-reactive protein. It's a common marker in an inflammation panel, but only in advanced cardiac panels are you likely to see this if you go to a normal doctor. It's one of the big three things in Bulletproof that I tell you you have to know, and it needs to be below one.
Exactly.
This is just for people listening so they understand what that is. And these other things you talked about, Borrelia, we're talking about Lyme disease and associated factors. HSV is a common virus that people get. And of course, leaky gut, most people have heard of. But these are things you wouldn't know about that are causing inflammation that is going to hit your brain 40 years from now, but you know they're happening now.
Exactly. And then you want to know, and I usually ask people, you know, how many people here would like to avoid Alzheimer's? Of course, everybody's hand goes up. And then I say, okay, how many people know their HSCRP? Probably about 5% of people know their HSCRP. How many people here know their vitamin D levels? And it's probably about 10%. How many people know their ApoE status? Do you have a copy of ApoE4? 0, 1, or 2? If you have 0 copies of ApoE4, then you have about a 9% chance during your lifetime to develop Alzheimer's. If you have a single copy, it's about a 30% chance. And if you have 2 copies, it's over 50%. So most likely you will develop Alzheimer's during your lifetime. So these are all things you'd like to know. You'd also like to know your fasting insulin level, because if your fasting insulin level is high, you are developing insulin resistance, which is an important risk factor for Alzheimer's disease and cognitive decline. You'd also like to know your hemoglobin A1C, of course. And then you'd also like to know whether you are exposed to specific toxins. And these are metallotoxins like mercury, organic toxins like DDE, for example, and of course, mycotoxins that you've talked about and studied extensively.
For mold.
There you go. Yep, mold. And so here's the big surprise. We wrote a paper back in 2015 showing that, in fact, many of these people ended up having exposure to mycotoxins. And who knew that mold was going to cause Alzheimer's disease? But for a subset of people, it absolutely does. And when you address that, you can get improvements in people. And if you don't address it, you're not going to get improvements. So we call the inflammatory one type 1 Alzheimer's, or hot or inflammatory. Then the glycotoxic one is type 1.5, because it actually gives you both the inflammation and the atrophic side, because you have insulin resistance. Type 2 is atrophic. You don't have enough support for your neural network, whether it's because of vitamin D, you know, B12, testosterone, estradiol, progesterone, pregnenolone, free thyroid, free T3, you know, on and on and on. You need all these things to sustain your neural network. And if you do not have these, you end up downsizing your neural network. So that is type 2 atrophic or cold Alzheimer's disease. And then type 3 is toxic. And this is often presenting in a very different way. These people actually look different, and you need to treat them differently if you're going to get rid of their toxin exposure.
Do you know how epic that 1-minute monologue was for everyone listening to this? You just summarized the end of Alzheimer's, your book, is sort of at least the main points in it. But here's the thing. We went from your brain's not working, here's a retirement home, and you're not going to know your kids' names, to saying you basically have one of these three things. There's an energy problem, there's a toxin problem, there's an inflammation problem, and sometimes there's overlapping. And all of those are hackable to one extent or another, or I guess to put it in doctor terms, curable. How easy is it to prevent these versus reverse them?
Yeah, the reality is it's easy to prevent them, easier certainly than reversing. And the reality is that Alzheimer's disease should be a rare disease. This is a $1 trillion global problem. Over $260 billion was spent last year by the United States in Alzheimer-related things, nursing homes, drugs, so forth and so on, lost wages. As you know, the caretakers for Alzheimer's patients also develop diseases, typically diseases associated with stress. They have shorter telomeres than controls. So this is a huge problem. And in fact, nobody should, or very, very few people should develop this problem. This is why we recommend that people get a cognoscopy. You can actually go on a website now, ahnphealth.com. You can get a direct-to-consumer set of tests that will look at what your risk factors are. It will subtype you and say, okay, you are most at risk for type 2 or type 1.5, et cetera, and give you an initial program so that you can actually prevent the disease. We haven't had anyone yet who's on prevention who has developed cognitive decline. Now, we'll see. It's early days. But people who are on reversal, the most important thing here is that they sustain their improvement, unlike with drug treatment. The idea of going after a complex chronic illness like Alzheimer's with a monotherapy actually makes no biological sense. As we tell the patients, imagine you have a roof with 36 holes in it, because initially we identified 36 different mechanisms that all contributed. And by the way, everyone we've seen so far with cognitive decline has between 10 and 25 different contributors. We haven't seen a single person yet who has only one contributor to their cognitive decline. So you want to identify these contributors, and then you want to address them. And as you said, the good news is these are all hackable. So you, in fact, can address all of the contributors. The most difficult ones are, in fact, the toxins. When you've got someone exposed to mycotoxins, you literally need to get them out of the house that is exposing them or the building that is exposing them. And you need to detoxify them with things like cholestyramine and then build things back with things like intranasal VIP. But the good news is all of these things can indeed be addressed.
I'm hoping right now there are a substantial number of listeners saying, oh my God, I need to get this for my parents or my spouse. Because these tests aren't terribly expensive. I don't know how much AHNP charges for them, but these are relatively common tests, at least most of them. If you want an advanced metals test or mycotoxin in blood or urine, they can be a little expensive, in the range of a few hundred dollars, but not a few thousand dollars.
Right.
And then all of a sudden you go from, well, I have the symptoms and it's inevitable, to, well, now I know something and I can make changes. How many of those holes do you need to patch, those holes in the roof, in order to reduce your risk to the point it's just unlikely? Do you have to perfectly fix all 36 of them, or is getting 8 of 12 going to get you so far along that you're happy with your life?
Actually, that's a really good point. So to go back for one moment to the cost, so it costs you about $120,000 per year to be in a nursing home. So you're talking about far less than 1% to do these tests. So yeah, it's a very good investment, in fact, to keep your faculties, as you know. And then as far as the tests, what happens is very similar to what has been seen in cardiovascular disease. As you know, with cardiovascular disease, what Dean Ornish found 30 years ago is that once you get over a threshold, it's a little bit like a snowball rolling downhill. You're either going down the right side or the wrong side. And what we found is that there is a synaptoblastic to synaptoclastic ratio. In other words, there's a whole set of signals that is causing you to form new memories and keep your memories. We call those synaptoblastic. And on the other hand, there is an antagonistic set, synaptoclastic, that are involved in reorganizing memories. And you're doing this all the time. When you're young, those are in balance. As you get older, if you're low on these various supports, or if you've got exposure, you've got inflammation, all the things we talked about, your synaptoclastic signaling outstrips your synaptoblastic signaling. So the good news is the feedback here is actually anti-homeostatic. So in biological systems, when you have a single goal outcome and you don't require signal amplification, you use, as you know, homeostatic feedback. That's negative feedback. Like your serum pH, you know, your serum pH, you want it to be 7.4. You never want it to be 10 or 2. And so if you have a exposure to some acid, you know, you drink a soda or something, then your body uses metabolic and respiratory compensation to drive you back to 7.4. However, when you have a system that requires signal amplification and multi-goal outcome, such as forming synapses, such as blood clotting, many other things, you actually have a feedback that enhances this. So it's a positive feedback. And by the way, this is where prions come from. So we call this prionic loop feedback. As you, for example, you know, you cut your hand and you're going to bleed to death if you don't make a clot in a certain amount of time, you have a system of serine proteases that feeds forward to develop that clot for you. And then, of course, over the next week or so, you begin to break that down. Same thing happens here. So the good news is, once you get over the hump, and the first patient we had out of the 36 holes, she addressed 12. But for her, that was enough. Now, the problem is we don't know ahead of time how many it's going to be. So we keep adding them because if we don't help the person, they're going to die of Alzheimer's. So we continue to add until they get reversal. And this first person, 12, for people in prevention, it's often 4 or 5. It's not a lot. For people, the farther down the road they are, the more of these you have to address.
Do you have a stack ranked list for the average person that says, this is the number one of 36 to go after because it's such a low hanging fruit, because it's so common, and this is number two? Could you tell listeners the top 5 things on your list?
Sure. So the way it works, though, is that it's personalized. So yeah, your top 5 will be different from my top 5, will be different from someone else's top 5. So we have a computer-based algorithm that we use that goes through each thing, all the different possibilities, and then says, okay, look, so here's an example. Dave, you know, if you have mycotoxin exposure and you have an HLA-DRDQ that is sensitive to mycotoxin exposure.
That would be me.
There you go. So that would likely be your biggest hole in your roof. That's going to be your number one priority. For many people, it will be hormonal imbalance. So you may have, if you have a, you know, an estradiol level that's very low, or if you have a testosterone level, or if your thyroid is very low, or your vitamin D is, you know, less than 20, these things could be very high on your list.
All of those were me in my 20s, but they're not me anymore.
And there you go. So you addressed all of these and probably averted some significant cognitive issues down the road. For many people, and I would say, you mentioned the top 5, if you just take the group as a whole, and that can be dangerous, of course, because, for example, we have about 5% of people, mercury is the critical number one. Until you address that, they won't get better. But for the other 95% of people, mercury is not a big issue. So no surprise, when you do these big population studies, you come away with the idea that mercury is not important. But for that 5%, mercury is very important. So if you look at the population, here are the big 5. Number one, glycotoxicity and insulin resistance. So most people have toxicity from sugar. We simply were not built, as you've pointed out many times, evolutionarily to handle the number of and the calories we get from simple carbs. And so we develop insulin resistance. We develop inflammation and sometimes metabolic syndrome due to the glycated proteins and our immune response to them. So that's one of the big 5. Second one, continued chronic inflammation due to typically different organisms, and we actually need to look for these organisms. And we're finding many people looking at PCR from urine, for example, many people who end up having not simply Borrelia, and they've often been treated for Lyme, but unfortunately they have a co-infection. They have Babesia, or they have Bartonella, or they have Ehrlichia, or Anaplasma. And until you address those things, they're not going to get rid of that chronic inflammation.
With Lyme disease or Borrelia, somewhere around 95% of people have some Lyme spirochetes present if you measure their urine, but they don't have any active Lyme disease. And it's been my experience from talking with a lot of people that most people don't get chronic Lyme until they're exposed to another toxin, usually mold toxins, sometimes mercury, but something takes out the immune system, then the Lyme grows, and then they get chronic inflammation where they're screwed. Do all of us need to worry about Lyme in the context of Alzheimer's or not?
So this is a great point, and it brings up the fact that, you know, what is Alzheimer's? As I was mentioning earlier, this is really a protective response to different insults. And so what happens is the amyloid that has been vilified in Alzheimer's, where the companies are telling you, we got to get rid of that amyloid, is very much like napalm. Imagine you've got the invaders, you know, breaching your borders. So you're going to put napalm down around the borders to try to kill the invaders. This is what your brain is doing with amyloid. It's putting down the amyloid because it is an antimicrobial, as shown very nicely by professors Robert Moyer and Rudy Tanzi from Harvard a number of years ago. You're putting this stuff down, but now you're living in a smaller, less arable soil, smaller country. You are literally downsizing. So, yes, what we call Alzheimer's is a chronic activation of the innate immune system, and amyloid beta is part of the innate immune system's response. So as you indicated, as long as you can keep the Borrelia at bay without your amyloid, you're in better shape. But as you now start to fail to do that, you've got to put down that napalm, that amyloid. And as long as you are fighting these various agents with amyloid, you are now downsizing. You are now at risk for Alzheimer's disease. And you may end up at the SCI stage, you may end up at the mild cognitive impairment stage, or you may end up going all the way to Alzheimer's. But that's why you need to address these things. And yes, there are many of them that can do this. And as an example, we had one patient who did very well and had the Borrelia treated years before, but was continuing to have incomplete recovery. And ultimately, we found out she had babesiosis, which is essentially a relative of malaria. It's a parasite. And as she's now been treated for her babesiosis, she's got continued improvement. So the answer is that, yes, you have to be concerned about these things. And as you pointed out, so many of us have been exposed to these. Now, one way to deal with them is simply enhancing our own immune system function, and that is through good diet, all the things that we do, sleep, lowering stress, exercise, and some people like to use the old approach that the Ayurvedics use, which is this triad of amalaki, ashwagandha, and tinospora. Very good way to support your immune system function. So again, there's a whole set of things. This is a concert. You've got to get everything right to get this. And now, you know, if you fail in these, then ultimately, yes, you've got to be concerned that you will have the Borrelia essentially loose, and that you've now got to use amyloid and that you are at risk for Alzheimer's disease.
Is there a case for maybe taking 1 month every year and just saying, all right, I'm going to take a broad spectrum of antiparasitics. I'm going to take the Ayurvedic trifecta you talked about there. I'm going to take mercury chelators. and I'm basically going to go through, because I don't know what I'm exposed to on a daily basis. Nobody does.
Right.
And just kind of going through and just cleansing the crap out of yourself, for lack of a better word, as a preventative approach. Or is this something that needs to be more nuanced on a regular basis? Because most people listening aren't actually going to go out and get the test. And most of them are going to do a few different things when they realize how much power and how much likelihood they have of getting Alzheimer's. And a shout out to Maria Shriver, who talked about all those statistics, how women get it quite a lot as well as men, and et cetera. But is this something that could work for people? Say, I don't really know which of these I have. I'm just going to get the big ones and just do it on a regular basis till I'm 120.
It's a great point. And so I think there are two ways to go about this. So one of the things we're doing actually is making this easier and easier and easier, because again, the reality is this should be something of our everyday lives. This should be something where, you know, nobody gets this, or very, very few people ever get this disease. So you're right. We need to know things like our fasting insulin. Homocysteine is another good one. You know, what's your status of methylation? And I do think this will become part of our lexicon. This will become part of our everyday lives. This will be part of the zeitgeist. You know, just as pretty much everybody knows what their cholesterol is, most people know what their blood pressure is. You know, you could have said 50 years ago, hey, who's going to go out and, you know, get a blood pressure cuff and actually check themselves? And hey, who's going to go and actually prick their finger and see what their glucose or their ketone level is? I think that when you realize that this will not only make a difference in whether you will develop a terminal illness or not, imagine if you could do the same thing, Dave, to tell you, Dave, you're never going to get cancer. Don't worry about it. You're never going to get cancer. It would be something that would be, hey, you know, something, maybe I want to check every now and then. So we want to make it easier and easier. But you're right. For today, many people will simply say, well, I want to do some things right. And yes, you've already talked about so many of these. You know, what we call the KetoFlex 12-3 diet, which I talked about in the book, low carbs, driving yourself into mild ketosis, having specific periods of fasting. You want to optimize your microbiome. There are some definitely some things you can do. Exercise, reduce your stress, you know, meditation, sleep. Sleep is a huge issue. Make sure you don't have sleep apnea. That's an important contributor for many, many people. Do some brain training. So there are, you know, some specific herbs and supplements you can take. All these sorts of things. Obviously, probiotics, prebiotics, make sure to heal your gut. So you can treat blind. I don't recommend treating blind because there are so many different things that can impact you. But I think as it becomes easier and easier that you can take, you know, a few hours and get checked out, I think that many, many people will realize that can literally save my life. And, you know, this is where we're headed for all complex chronic illnesses. I'm working with people now also with macular degeneration, with Parkinson's, with Lewy body. These things are all things that can be prevented. Chronic illness medicine and health is completely different than 20th century medicine. You need to address it differently.
Dale, I feel like if people were to apply your Alzheimer's protocols and just say, well, what would happen with macular degeneration? They would see similar things. And a lot of the research that I drew on to write Headstrong, I looked at Alzheimer's research, including yours, and I looked at Parkinson's, because these are the worst case in scenarios. And I was focused very specifically on energy production, which I think would be more type 3 in your thing, but relevant to all of them. But the idea is, if you reduce your odds of one chronic disease, you're probably going to reduce your odds of all chronic diseases, at least some.
Yes.
Do you agree with that mindset?
So here's the interesting thing. There's a Venn diagram, obviously, where you've got a core that is absolutely similar. You're right. So many of these illnesses are related to our microbiome, our leaky gut, our use of high simple carbs. The bottom line is we are, by the way we are living, giving ourselves these diseases. And our doctors are not recognizing that. And they're telling us, hey, you've got some disease. We don't know why you get it. Or let me give you a drug that doesn't work very well. This is a very old-fashioned way to deal with these things. You're absolutely right. However, the Venn diagram does not have a perfect concordance. Yes. And here's an example. You are at increased risk for macular degeneration if you're APOE4 negative, and you're at increased risk for Alzheimer's if you're APOE4 positive. So there are definite differences, but the good news is there's a lot of basic research that now points us to the pathophysiology of each one of these. So you can see essentially what I would call, so my argument is these are what I would call mismatch diseases. So this is the mismatch theory of neurodegeneration that I'm suggesting, where any time you've got a chronic or repeated mismatch between supply and demand, you have a network downsizing. if the supply and demand is on trophic support for the brain where plasticity is an issue, you develop Alzheimer's. If it's for your macula, where there's, as you know, a very, very high metabolic rate, and the demand there is because anytime you're looking at blue light, if you're staying up late, if you're looking, if you've got more light exposure, again, than we were meant to support, if you've got specific genetics, things like the CFH gene, as you know, if you've got too low zinc, too low trophic factors. So now the same story, but in that system. Same story if you now move it to mitochondrial complex 1, you develop Parkinson's. And for each of these, the downsizing program is designed to relieve the greatest amount of stress with the least loss. So in fact, this is why people walk around with the pathophysiology of Alzheimer's for 20 years. They still drive, they still play tennis, they still do their work. They start to have trouble memorizing new things. They begin to lose that plasticity. But you've got the same sort of thing for each of these diseases. So you're right, there's a lot of core similarity, but there are also specifics for each one of these, and you can address them.
I'm looking at the speed of your work. You came out with RECODE, your reversal of cognitive decline protocol, in 2014.
Right.
And here we are 4 years later, and a lot of the tests that you use in that are widely available. You can order them at home without even having to go to the doctor. And it seems like the speed of the knowledge for Alzheimer's is pretty good. And I feel like the speed of our understanding of the many different factors that go into the things that take us out, heart disease, cancer, diabetes, Alzheimer's, macular degeneration, I actually put on that list as well. Those are the things that kill most people, right. If it's not, falling rocks or something.
Right.
Do you feel like we're getting to the point in the next 5 years, 10 years, where we're going to know enough that a person with the motivation and reasonable means can go out and say, I'm going to get tested every 1 or 2 years, understand where I am on all these things, so we can avoid all of those deaths from those causes?
Absolutely. And you can do most of this now, as you know. I really do believe we are at an inflection point. As you know, we worked on this in the lab for 30 years, very slowly, looking at cells dying and mice and making mice better with Alzheimer's. But we're now to the point where we can actually see human beings getting better. We can actually see what drives the neurodegenerative process. So yes, I certainly think just as you're hacking these various different biological parameters, we are now able to look at what's contributing to most of these illnesses for people. And so, yes, I think it will be more and more common for people to prevent and especially early reversal of all of these diseases.
What's next? So after we've gotten rid of these primary big causes of mortality, put on your future hat. You spent many, many years looking at Alzheimer's and brains, and you're a physician. What should I be worried about on my path to live to 180 after I've hacked all of these in my own biology?
Well, this is a really good point because, the 20th century medicine was about what it is, and we were able to treat simple diseases like pneumococcal pneumonia and TB. 21st century medicine, which is unfortunately not being practiced in the vast majority of practices today, is about why. And so you're looking at all of the different parameters. So there must be a much better interaction between Silicon Valley and healthcare. And that has failed so far. We've done things like electronic medical records, but in terms of applying very large data sets to these complex chronic illnesses, which is absolutely what's needed, this hasn't been done. Every doctor's office should have tremendous computing power because they are dealing with human organisms that are incredibly complex. Now, after that is done, we now can prevent Alzheimer's, prevent most of these chronic illnesses. The question is, if we've gotten rid of acute illnesses and we've gotten rid of most of the chronic illnesses, we are actually now really left with the chronometer. We're left with the aging phenomenon. So what's interesting is the aging research right now is debased and adulterated because there's so much of complex chronic illness. We're killing ourselves with these various things that we're doing wrong. once we optimize things for our evolution, now we really do peel back the onion and you really do see, what is the underlying aging process? Now the good news is we can start addressing that. If the first thing that's going to get you is your telomeres, okay, you can address that. If the first thing that's going to get you, no, it's actually going to be, it's going to be your DNA, mutation. It's going to be, for example, mitochondrial mutations. As you know, if you look at what is the ratio from birth to death, the highest change, it is in mitochondrial DNA mutations. It's many orders of magnitude, as you know. If it turns out to be misfolded proteins, so now we actually will be able to focus on aging research. Most of what we call aging today is you sucked at living, right? I mean, isn't that really what it is? You know, you ate sugar, you went to the wrong doctor, you took medicines for everything, you sucked at living. And that's most of what we call aging right now. So
that's my favorite quote from all of Bulletproof Radio. Okay, sorry, keep going.
but isn't that true? Most of us are not doing the right things, and that's what's killing us. So the really cool future is we've gotten rid of the infectious stuff. We now are on to the chronic illnesses. And by the way, that reveals all sorts of new infections. As you mentioned earlier, Borrelia is so fundamentally different than pneumococcal pneumonia. It really is the neurosyphilis of the 21st century. So now we get rid of these pathogens. We get rid of these biofilms. We start to do the right things with our living. We optimize what we are doing evolutionarily. Now we reveal what aging is really all about. And now you say, okay, hey, Dave, you know what? Your telomeres are looking good, but you know what? You need some stem cells. Okay, you get your stem cells. And now you really do begin to see. I always tell people we want to make it so that you can live happily and healthily till 100. But now you're going to live to 120, 140, as you said, maybe 180. What is now the next limiting feature? And a lot of it is going to be taken care of with things like stem cells, appropriate folding of proteins, removing your senescent cells, potentially. As you know, yes, there's a big push to removing the senescent cells. So now you're actually going to look at aging instead of simply chronic illness.
That is such a powerful summary. And the reason I asked you the question was a little bit self-serving, because I feel like I've got a good handle on my risk for these major killers. And I know that there are people who lived 120 today. So, all right, that's doable. And I'm going to do everything I can to make that happen. And I'm counting on another 50% of my lifespan from new technology, but I'm not even sure what that new technology is going to be aimed at yet. But those things you just named are the top ones on my list as well. Is it telomeres? And I'm doing some stuff to lengthen my telomeres. But if we say that that's really important and we start applying as much energy to lengthening telomeres as we do to, I'm just going to say, useless heart disease research that hasn't generated any benefits over the last 50 years. That sort of economics into it would change everything. And I want to make sure that I'm way ahead of the curve, because that whole not dying thing is part of my anti-aging strategy. So yep. I'm always looking to learn from someone with your incredible knowledge of these things. And
no question, dying gets in the way of healthy aging. No question.
Yeah. Step one, don't die.
Exactly.
And everything else is a detail, right?
So one of the things I was going to say, I'm really interested in is how do we make it so that our children and the teenagers and the 20-somethings plan their lives? I think strategic living is going to be more and more common and more important. Our own two daughters do many things that I didn't know to do when I was their age. And so they're eating the right things, they're doing the right things, they're checking the right blood values that I didn't know to check. And I think both strategic conception, getting a healthy baby, and strategic living will be much more common with these generations.
My very first book was called The Better Baby Book, and it's what we did for our own children to give them that head start, because you want to talk about leverage.
Yeah.
It's 3 months before you get pregnant is when you have the best leverage, and, yeah, and you lose leverage with every minute of every day until you're 120. It always declines. It's just so easy to get one little variable right, like fewer neurotoxins in the first trimester. If your mom did that, even better yet, her mom did that, your odds of living a very long time go up dramatically. And I find I have great hope because I see what I did when I was 16, thinking it was a good thing, or at least that it wasn't harmful, and just knowing now what a complete train wreck that was. And I believe that we've learned enough as a species that what our teenagers are doing now is more directionally accurate than, because we all think it's right. But when I was a kid eating, you know, Coke, and, you know, beverages like that, just full of sugar, because, hey, it's just calories. As long as I don't have too many calories, it doesn't matter. It was just wrong, but yeah, I thought it was right.
Absolutely.
Is there a chance that what we're telling people to do now is just fundamentally wrong, and we're going to find out 50 years from now that we were completely clueless?
Very interesting point. So as you'll recall, Roy Walford years ago was interested in living a very, very long time, and unfortunately ended up dying of ALS. And one of the suggestions that's been made is that you can drive yourself, you know, too much, and in fact put too much stress. So what happens is you have different systems, each of which has a stress point. Therefore, you can drive yourself to less Alzheimer's, but you may end up with something else. And one of the arguments for ALS is that you have to clear glutamate from your synapses. You literally have to have a certain amount of energy to do that and to deal with this. So in your efforts to try to drop your energy level and have greater longevity, you may end up hurting yourself because you actually have to have a certain amount of energy to deal with everyday living. So I think the key is going to be that, although I think we all agree that many of these approaches are helpful, we were not made to have insulin resistance, you know, so forth and so on. But you're absolutely right. If we're not careful, we can expose other problems. And I'll tell you one we've run into with the treatment of cognitive decline. We get people on, you know, we're driving them into mild ketosis from 1.5 millimolar to 4 millimolar beta hydroxybutyrate. We're getting rid of their insulin resistance, reestablishing insulin sensitivity, addressing their pathogens, addressing detox, all these things. But what we found is that the people who have low BMIs, typically below 20, they, as they're now decreasing their carbs, they don't have the adipose tissue to produce the ketones that are supporting their cognition. So what happens, they're the ones that actually have problems at the beginning. And so we now often have to add exogenous ketones or more MCT oil, things like that, to make sure that they actually check them. We've had a few who will actually develop gut problems, lose weight, and actually take a step back in the cognitive decline before we address the fact that, you guys are not able at this point to generate those endogenous ketones. So we, in fact, need to help you and get your weight up, liberalize your diet, cycle in and out of ketosis, all those sorts of things. So as we learn more and more, we can tweak this and make it better and better. But yes, you're right. These things are not black and white. You have to, for each person, customize this for his or her genetics, his or her biochemistry. You know, we always talk about genotype and phenotype, but we also want to include the chemotype. Where do they stand with their biochemistry so that we can address all these appropriately?
You mentioned cyclical ketosis there, which is something that is a core part of Bulletproof. And I look at people who are on higher carb diets, and they're always in a state of relatively high glucose.
Right.
And it never changes. And when you get the idea that, okay, that's bad, it's very easy, the way humans think, to say, all right, I want to be in full-blown ketosis all the time, unrelenting, unending. And that also seems sort of like the other side of the coin of excessive high glucose versus with excessive high ketones. Whereas we might want to be able to metabolize carbs. So we go out of ketosis and back into ketosis and usually have some ketones floating around because of MCTs or because we fast on a regular basis.
Right.
Do you see long-term problems with having high ketone levels and just no carbs ever? Or is that going to work for Alzheimer's and things?
So far what's seen is that having chronic ketosis seems to be a good thing for mentation and seems to help you. However, as you know, over time, you can develop essentially some resistance. You can lose the metabolic flexibility, the very metabolic flexibility you're trying to achieve. And this is why for many people, it is a good idea every once in a while, whether you do it once every week or once every 2 weeks, to cycle out of that briefly to keep yourself metabolically flexible. That seems to work better.
And that's something that I hope comes out. I know when I started talking about that, some of the, I'll call them the keto bros, you know, all ketosis all the time. And, mm-hmm. you know, if you ever have a carb again, you're in league with the devil. And it doesn't seem to work like that biologically. Is there a role, though, if someone is in the early stages of Alzheimer's disease, is there a role for them to have even moderate amounts of starch on a somewhat of a basis to support the glial cells in the brain that want glucose? Or at that stage, when you're that far down, the beginnings of Alzheimer's, you just look to heck with glucose. It's all about ketones.
Well, so resistant starches and some starchy vegetables, these things are very reasonable. And so we certainly include those. Again, you don't want to go crazy on sugar. Things like resistant starches and some starchy vegetables. So yes, we do need protein. And by the way, protein, as you know, too much protein can also give you problems with insulin resistance. So we typically suggest typically 0.8 to 1.0 grams per kilogram of lean body mass. But if you are detoxing, as you know, you need to go higher than that. So again, it depends on where you stand. If you are, you know, if you're a person with type 3 Alzheimer's, you need to increase the protein a little bit. So yes, there's a role for all of those macronutrients as well as many, many phytonutrients and micronutrients. But typically, you don't need sugar.
I could not agree more with you there. Although sugar is delicious, I gotta say.
Yeah, it's amazing. How much of a drug it really is.
I mean, I hear people say I couldn't give up sugar, and I say, you know, I know someone else who sounded like that, but their problem was heroin. And you know, I'm sure heroin's delicious. Never tried it, but it's the same sort of thing. You just don't do that. And if you get a couple of grams of sugar that was in your asparagus, it doesn't matter. But if you're putting teaspoons of it on there, it does matter. And since we have stevia and we have monk fruit and we have xylitol, you can still have a sweet taste. You don't have to live life in eating cardboard all the time, which doesn't work.
Exactly. And you've got berries and things like that.
Right. And all right. So I've got two more questions for you. There's a declining group of people who still say you need to be on a low-fat diet if you don't want to get heart disease. And you know, you should eat less than 10% of your calories from fat, and you should have lots of starchy carbs and things like that. How does that jive with your work?
It's a very interesting question, and of course, it's an ongoing controversy. We're going very simply by what makes your brain function better without hurting you. And so, as you know, the brain needs fat. The patients we're dealing with are typically on diets that are 70% of the calories from good fats. And initially, actually, as you know, medium chain triglycerides and things, so saturated fatty acids as well. And then at the time they go on, they check their LDL particle number. And you can literally adjust this. If your LDL particle number is too high, you can go down on the saturated fats, and you can go up on the monounsaturates and polyunsaturates. And if it's good, you can balance those. And what we find is that these people do well. Low-fat diets are associated with smaller brains, as you know, with some atrophy. And so we want to be careful about that. And as an example, one of the people we're dealing with has APOE4/4, the very person who's not supposed to eat much fat. She eats 70% of her diet calories with fats, good fats, has some protein, has some no simple carbohydrates. And is doing extremely well. And by the way, her lipid profile is outstanding. And her LDL particle number, less than 1,000. She looks great and has clean coronary arteries. So I think that the reality was, it was something that people tried to get these lipid numbers down low, but it has not turned out to be good for your brain overall.
So we end up saying, I'm going to reduce my risk of heart attacks, which is also debatable when you look at all the data. But you do that at the cost of your brain. It's not a good strategy. And I've been on diets like that when I was trying to lose the 100 pounds of fat I used to carry around. And you don't feel good on it.
Right.
And you might feel good for a little while, but then it's just not a good thing. And I would like people listening to say, look, if you try a diet like that and your brain works and you're losing weight and your numbers look good, you know, more power to you. That's awesome. It just doesn't seem to work for the vast majority of people. And the ones who do it, over time, the decline is apparent. And what we're looking to do is create this nutritional profile that says, I'm not going to get Alzheimer's disease. I'm not going to get cancer. I'm not going to get diabetes. And I'm not going to get heart disease. And to get all of those at the same time, it's going to be individualized. But the general rules are tons of vegetables, like you said, phytonutrients, right? Not eating sugar. And what about grains? I would just say don't eat grains. But yeah. Where are you on that?
Yeah, so it's a good point. So the big four we always talk about are simple carbs, grains, dairy, and lectins. Now, different people can handle different amounts of those. Some people are more sensitive. And again, lectins, we kind of go last because it depends if you are particularly sensitive to them. And if you have autoimmune problems, think about those. Things yep. like it's basically getting rid of nightshades and legumes. But it, as a general rule, grains, whole grains have been used, as you know, they do have a nice effect because of the the fiber, et cetera. And they do have some protein and things, but they do have potential damage. And so we generally suggest to people, until you know more, stay away from grains and really focus on the vegetables, the low glycemic fruit. You want to have a very high, both soluble and insoluble fiber. It helps your biome. It helps your absorption of any sort of carbohydrates. It is great for detoxing. So these are very, very helpful. So in general, we suggest people stay away from grains.
Me too. If someone came to you tomorrow, Dale, and said, I want to perform better at everything I do as a human being, you know, not just from a medical perspective, but just at life. What are your three most important pieces of advice? What would you offer them?
So I would say, first of all, get a cognoscopy check. In other words, check out your biochemistry. If you happen to have methylation issues that maybe other people don't have, you can address those today. As you indicate, you know, as you've said for years, these things are hackable. And in fact, optimization is hackable. So step one is get directions for what you need to hack based on your genetics and based on your biochemistry. The second thing, get direction based on your psychology. Many people will say, okay, I understand there's a program here, it's going to help me, but I just don't want to do it, or I don't like it. Some people like, you know, need the carrot, some people need the stick. One of the guys I worked with, by the way, who had a tremendous increase in the hippocampal volume, did absolutely great, APOE4 positive, PET scan proven Alzheimer's disease, he's done very well. He said, I need a dominatrix. And I said, you're talking to the wrong guy.
A food dominatrix, right?
He needed somebody to say, you've got to do this program. Because he was under a lot of stress. He would go home on Friday night after working very hard at his job and get a couple of pints of ice cream and down him. And of course, that was hurting him. It turned out he had many, many different metabolic alterations that were all fixable. And when they were fixed, he did absolutely great. And he's doing great to this day. He's about 3.5 years into this. So that would be number two, get the right psychology for you. And then number three, I would say, step back and have the joy that we should all have. We're all so worried about everything from politics to, you know, whether we achieved what we wanted to achieve, that are we going to die tomorrow? And I think that having a positive attitude about these and recognizing this stuff is doable. You know, as Steve Jobs said, the people who are crazy enough to think that they're going to change the world are the ones that actually end up doing it. And so you can do it. You know, each person, you optimize your, you know, your biochemistry and given your genetics, optimize your psychology, and then step back and recognize that there's a tremendous amount of excitement to living. And that, you know, you can make the changes that other people are telling you you can't make.
Absolutely love that. One final question, we'll call it a bonus question. Coffee and Alzheimer's.
Great
question.
Good
or bad?
Well, you know, it's really interesting you should mention that. The data are clear. People who drink coffee, typically 5 cups or more per day, have a lower risk for Alzheimer's. Now, that's not to say it's the optimal thing to do. Necessarily, be careful about your adrenals, as you know.
Yep.
And as you've pointed out, there can be stuff in some coffees that you want to avoid. But in fact, people have tried for years to show that coffee is bad for you. They've never really been able to do it. And so the reality is you increase that cyclic AMP. You could actually look back and see why in the 1950s and 60s, people had coffee and a cigarette after lunch. You get the cyclic AMP up, you get that nicotinic acetylcholine receptor activated, you're going to remember better, and you're going to form new memories, and you're going to function better. We know now you don't want to include the cigarette, but the reality is we're understanding more about these pathways. And in fact, increasing your cyclic AMP, whether you do it by coffee or other means, is good for you. We also recommend people increase their BDNF and things like that, but we're understanding more and more the pathways that are giving you better function and preventing decline. And coffee contributes to an important one.
It's funny you mentioned nicotine. I just did an interview with a professor from Vanderbilt who published the first study in 1988 on oral nicotine, not smoking, but actually eating nicotine to treat Alzheimer's disease. So maybe those 1950s and 60s people with their coffee and cigarettes, smoking's nasty. Maybe they're onto something here. In fact, while we're on that, I think I'll have 1 milligram of nicotine. There. No, I'm set for the
very
day.
Very interesting.
All right, Dale.
All right, Dale.
I love your work. Everyone listening, it's Dr. Bredesen, drbredesen.com. His book is called The End of Alzheimer's. You actually need to read this book. I don't use need. It's a weasel word normally. But seriously, if you want to join me on this Living to 180 thing, there is groundbreaking info. It totally blew my mind. Absolutely worth your time.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Dave.
If you liked today's episode, you know what to do. Head on over to Amazon and pick up a copy of Dale's book and read it. And when you're done reading it, leave a review for him that says, this book was worth my time, if you think it was, which it will be. And since you're already on Amazon, you're already leaving reviews, tell someone about the Bulletproof Diet or Headstrong or Bulletproof Coffee. Just take a second to leave a few of those little 5-star reviews, because people who make good stuff like Dale's book, we notice that stuff, and we're always thankful if you take the time to do it. Have an awesome day.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.